Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matthew Appleby, Horticulture Week Editor, and this is the Hort Week podcast. And today I'm with Fiona Davison, who's Head of Libraries and Exhibitions at the RHS. And Fiona's got a new book out called An Almost Impossible Thing, The Radical Lives of Britain's Pioneering Women Gardeners. And that's out in September. So welcome, Fiona.
Hello.
Excellent. Now, great to have you on. With this amazing book, which I've had a really good look through, and you've managed to uncover some hidden stories. So can you tell us what the premise of the book is?
Yeah, I mean, I think people know about some of the well-known Edwardian lady gardeners, you know, Gertrude Jekyll, Ellen Wilmot. They're all really well-known, highly respected even today. But I think what's much, much less well-known is the professional gardeners. So, you know, the people who we know about and hear about are the people who were very wealthy, had lots of resources, and were able to, you know, kind of garden in their own large gardens. But less well known are the professional gardeners, and particularly women professional gardeners. And I kind of stumbled on this story. I wasn't looking for it. I was looking for men gardeners, actually, which is a kind of odd hobby to have. But I was looking for stories of Wisley gardeners when I was doing research for the old laboratory exhibition. And we uncovered a bundle of letters in the Lindley Library from O. Harrison, claiming a scholarship, which was the prize for coming top in the RHS's professional exam in 1898. And the letter said you can't have the scholarship because you're a woman. And the scholarship was to train at the RHS garden at Chiswick, and Chiswick didn't train women. And I got kind of fascinated from that point on about, well, who were, you know, was this woman an oddity, or were there more, and what happened to them?
No, I mean, that's an amazing find, and so valuable. So how did it go from there then? How did you manage to get it from finding this letter into sort of book form?
It just grew. So I kind of started tracking down O. Harrison, and we put out an appeal, and we found out it was a lady called Olive, and we tracked down her descendants, and that was lovely. But then the RHS would publish its exam lists in its journal. So we had all these names, and then COVID happened, and I started kind of idly in my own spare time, just out of curiosity, looking for these names to see which ones were women. And then COVID happened and we were locked down, and my husband had cornered the sourdough bread market. So kind of I, to keep myself vaguely sane and busy in my spare time, just started online looking up these names in genealogy sites and kind of tracking them down online. And it just grew and grew and grew to the point that I did get so kind of obsessed with them, really, and so convinced that there was a story that we should know about, that then ended up as a book.
And why do you think this story is so important?
Well, I mean, on one level, you can dismiss them and you can say, well, none of them, these so the time period we're talking about here is from the 1890s through to the First World War. That's when this kind of little golden moment, this boom in women wanting to start careers in gardening happened. None of them really made it to the very tippy top of the horticultural profession. You don't see them, you know, managing Chatsworth or, you know, great big gardens. So on one level, you can dismiss it as, you know, just kind of vaguely interesting. But I think that there were so many of them and they worked so hard to craft independent lives through horticulture, and they were quietly successful in changing attitudes about what women could do within horticulture. And I think that on the back of their achievements of kind of normalising women doing high-end skilled tasks, working hard, you know, physical work, it really did change attitudes. And it's off the back of them doing that that future generations of women have been able to kind of increasingly easily enter the profession.
Oh, indeed. I mean, recently I wrote an obituary for The Guardian of Peter Thoday from Victorian and Edwardian Kitchen Gardener. And the gardener in question there was Harry Dodson. And back then, this sort of era he was representing was all about the man in the garden and the woman in the kitchen. But it wasn't always the case, clearly.
Yeah. And I mean, there was a big pushback. It has to be said, there was a big, strong negative pushback from the horticultural establishment. For most male gardeners were not receptive to this idea at all. And there's some absolutely corking letters in Gardener's Chronicle, the predecessor publication to Hort Week, and in Journal of Horticulture. You know, lots and lots of outraged letters of, if we let women in, this is the very end of the profession. You can kiss goodbye to any, you know, respectability, and the British garden is doomed if you let these monsters in skirts in. So it wasn't easy by any, you know, there wasn't an open door at all.
Do you think the women brought a different style, or, you know, something different to what the men did who were traditionally doing this type of work?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think two things. One is that the women who, by and large, trained at these gardening schools, sat the exam, and you know, worked to enter the profession, they're middle class women by and large, because the gardening schools charged quite a considerable fee. And anyway, it was the middle class. There was this notion at the time of the idea of surplus women, that if a woman didn't marry and have a man to look after her, she was a problem. If she was a middle-class woman, if she was a working-class woman, not a problem, go to work in a factory, become a domestic servant. But it was what to do with these surplus, they called them surplus women, surplus middle-class women who wouldn't or couldn't marry. So they're middle-class, they're educated, and they are often very influenced by the arts and crafts movement, very influenced by William Robinson, and very into the term at the time was wild gardening, so a more naturalistic gardening. And they actually made quite a kind of snobbish play that the conventional male gardener liked carpet bedding and formal and was rigid and boring, whereas they were better educated and more tasteful and artistic and liked this new style of wild gardening. So there's that element. And then the other thing that's really, I think, fundamentally different is, and I, you know, you can speculate as to why this is, but certainly when you look at the biographies of these women and where they gardened and what they did, they're very much gardening with a social purpose. So they're definitely, yes, doing it because they want to earn a living and they like gardening and they're clearly, you know, very, very committed to horticulture, but very often it's horticulture with a purpose. So they're working in therapeutic gardens, hospital gardens, asylum gardens, working with patients and teaching and helping them grow, or they're working in schools and doing educational work, or they're doing urban gardening to kind of green and improve dilapidated and slum areas. A lot of you know, work with the Metropolitan Public Gardens Association, that kind of thing. So they've often got a kind of other agenda going on. They're wanting to make a difference with their skills.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Now, but didn't after World War One, you talked about the surplus women. It wasn't the more surplus women after World War One. So did this carry on, you know, in an upward curve?
Well, yeah, it's really strange. So the World War One was a moment when actually for once the gardeners of Britain needed women and wanted them. So you see a shift because the men have, you know, been called up. Ornamental horticulture was not a protected, you know, occupation. They were conscripted, and there was also a massive labour shortage in the countryside for people with horticultural skills to help with food security. So women get their opportunity during the First World War, and a lot of them do get the bigger places and you know, more responsibility. But the minute the war ends, it turns on a sixpence, there's a sudden shift of get back into the kitchen, you must make way because the men are coming back. There was a real worry that if there weren't jobs for returning servicemen, that there would be kind of unrest and even revolution. You know, the Russian Revolution hadn't happened that long ago. And there was a real worry about it. So the women were promptly elbowed out and it was back to square one. And in a way, even worse, because the in terms of kind of women's representation in gardening, in a way, it was even worse and harder because there was then a depression, wasn't so much money to, you know, pay for the upkeep of these gardens. A lot of stately homes had kind of gone into decline and were shut up. So there was fewer opportunities around for everybody. And it was tougher. And so it actually went backwards a bit in the 20s and 30s and kind of only really recovered again as you go into another war and women are needed again.
What do you think the situation's like today? You know, I'll give an example. I don't know if it's a very good example, but we did a load of research into Victoria Medals of Honour, for instance, and all the other top awards in horticulture. And there's something like 30 out of 300 have been awarded to women since they started in, you know, the 1890s, and not really getting any better. So, you know, I thought this is a great story and put it out there and didn't get hardly any reaction at all. And a lot of women, well, because I mean, some women like well-known women horticulturists like Jacobo Vicker were very sort of keen on it. But what do you think the situation's like today is basically what I'm trying to ask.
I think it's mixed. I think it's mixed, frankly, as in like most professions. So you've got, you know, the traditional thing that hit, you know, the women I'm talking about was the other aspect was you had to make a choice. You either committed to your career or you got married. You could not do both. It was hard and fast and, you know, clear cut. It was the marriage bar. It didn't matter how radical you were. If you got married and had kids, that was it. And that wasn't a barrier that men faced. And a kind of softer version of that, I think, you know, still applies not just in gardening, but in other professions too, that we, you know, there's a kind of common pattern that women do childcare and go part-time. And that does make it harder to progress to the very top of professions. So you see a big lag. But if you look at kind of lower down in professions, not just gardening, but wider, it's much more 50-50. I think gardening, it's kind of professional horticulture, it's also muddied a little bit by the number of people who are second career, you know, coming in. But it takes time for any kind of, you know, new type of people to get the representation at all levels that mean that you've got, it's kind of not unusual for people to be operating, you know, at the high level with the resources and the, you know, the access to opportunities for long enough that you get a reputation going that gets you eventually to get, you know, a goal of one shade or another.
No, I mean, I know I saw in the book that you mentioned Sarah Ebley as record RHS gold medal winner. And I remember we sort of did some research to find that out a few years ago. And but I remember talking to her about, you know, why so few women gardeners designed Chelsea Show Gardens. And she said, for the very reasons you just said, that they do have children and don't have that reputation. And but she even sort of hinted that it was a kind of commitment to reach the top. She said, you know, you have to actually give it 100%. And that sort of opened my eyes a bit, that there was, you know, sort of two sides to it.
I think particularly with show gardens and the big, you know, the big ticket gardens, that there is a kind of conservatism with a little c, that you recognize and reward what you're familiar with, and that means that, say, if a sponsor is sponsoring a big garden and it's a massive commitment of money, they want a gold medal at the end of it, almost guaranteed, you know, if they're going to put that money in. So what do? They look around it in the past, who's won a gold medal? And so it becomes self-perpetuating. And I think the RHS is working really hard to try and change that in shows by opening up new categories of garden, your show gardens, where, you know, that there's less at stake financially slightly. And that means that sponsors and are more willing to kind of, you know, go with a different type of gardener outside of that kind of safe bet, people who won't have got sackfuls of gold on their CV. So I think that it is changing, and it will change more. But yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask, you know, contemporary women garden designers and gardeners what barriers they've faced and what motivates them as to whether, you know, whether it's they even want to do this.
No, true. No, I'm doing a bit of work on that type of thing. But I was in the National Portrait Gallery the other day, and I saw that Jekyll and Sackville West, they were very prominently portrayed. Okay, it's been redesigned, so basically it used to be mostly men, and now it's like kind of half and half, gender split. And I mean, is that a sort of common thing now in sort of history and libraries and museums, that, you know, we are moving towards much more recognition of women?
Yeah, I mean, it's slow going because it's hard to gather the evidence, because if you know, women aren't recognised in their day, they're not written about, and then the written evidence isn't there, and, you know, on you go. So you do have to dig deeper into the archives to kind of get there. But yeah, and I think also partly everybody loves to discover something new and an untold story. And the story of women in any, you know, ever so many different arenas has largely been untold. You look at how many statues there are of women, real women, not goddesses, and, you know, real women who are not goddesses or queens, and it's absolutely tiny. Absolutely tiny. So they're not in their lifetime or immediately after kind of memorialised. So the history has to work a bit harder. You have to work a bit harder to you know, tell their stories.
No, it's true. I mean, it's the same with blue plaques. I went to the unveiling of blue plaque for Fanny Wilkinson in London last year, I think. And I think there was hardly any blue plaques for women, particularly, and obviously none for women gardeners, or hardly any.
Yeah. I mean, it's even harder when your memorial, if you like, is your garden. Because they change and they're transitory and they're subject to, you know, threat. And if you're not somebody who's got, if you're not gardening for or are yourself someone with status, your garden doesn't get protected and curated, and, you know, kind of, it just has to take its chances with every other bit of the landscape. And that was the other thing I was kind of trying to find, gardens that had been designed by Madeleine Agar, who's one of the women I you know, researched in depth, and she was really successful in her time, but there's hardly anything, because she wasn't, the gardens weren't of that status that, you know, the National Trust has taken them on and they're, you know, looked after in that way.
No, she fascinated me, because I live in Wimbledon, and she designed the sort of war memorial garden on the common, didn't she? So I've gone past that, and I didn't know who designed it, but now I do, so I'm glad I read your book. I mean, just one little thing I noted, and sort of noted, that the chief of the NFU, the HGA, the RHS, and a DEFRA are all women. I don't know, does that mean anything?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it means something in terms of visibility, and I think it does. I think it all helps. I mean, the first RHS president as a woman, Elizabeth Banks, isn't that long ago. But, you know, you go into the council chamber and it's just men, and one woman. So, you know, kind of it does help in terms of visibility of women and showing kind of women at the top of organisations leading.
What if they're not very popular women, like the person in charge of DEFRA?
Well, yeah, you see, the thing is that is it. You've got to do, for, to be beneficial, you've got to be good at your job.
well, so you've done a lot of podcasts for the RHS. So what's it like being on the other side?
Yeah, it's odd, really, because I haven't got a script. Normally I've got my wee script, which I kind of vaguely go with. And then apart from the bit in red, which says, Fiona, ad lib here. I got my question list. I got my question list. I haven't got my question list, so that's, yeah, feels a little bit. It was an odd thing. Again, that's a complete accident. Lockdown, you know, we had to keep going, try and keep a presence digitally. And, you know, there's the virtual Chelsea thing, and they were looking around for somebody who could kind of witter on without access to a garden, you know, and can say things without access to one of our gardens or one of our shows. And I've got ever so many kind of stories and anecdotes from the archives that I could burble about. So, yeah.
No, that's good stuff. So what about the next book? Have you got one on the go?
I have no idea, because I don't have it. This is my second book, and both of them started with me finding something. I'm getting a little bit obsessed. In no way is there a program or plan, and both of them have been done in my spare time, which means they take an age. So both of them took about 4 years each. So I'm kind of quite enjoying not at the moment.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I was in the MCC library the other day, which is run by a guy from Gateshead, Neil, and he was saying to me, you know, I haven't got an idea for another book. And I was thinking, I bet you have, but you just don't want to tell me because you don't want me to steal it. but the MCC Library, for example, is another place where they're desperately trying to sort of move away from that very stuffy, white, middle-class kind of milieu, which is around gardening and so many other areas. But yeah. But anyway, that's by the by. We're coming towards the end of our podcast, but at the end, Fiona, we ask all our guests what their favorite plant is, which is I warned you of this earlier on, so you've had time to think. So what do you reckon?
Well, yeah, my mind always goes blank if I'm asked this, so I'm looking out of my spare bedroom window out onto my garden, and I can see that the fence is held up by a really thriving ivy. And although that might seem a bit boring, it's a great plant, loved by pollinators all year round, and as I say, it keeps my fence up, so you can't knock that.
That's a great choice.
Bog standard, dark green. London.
Well, that's a great one. When I did my RHS level 2, that was the only Latin name I learned. So, and I passed. Hey.
Latin names are my terror, because I take a running leap at them and hope I get through.
I like it. Right.
And rely on my accent to get me through.
I'm going to use that one. Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much to Fiona Davison, who is the author of An Almost Impossible Thing, The Radical Lives of Britain's Pioneering Women Gardeners, our little taller books now. And I'm Matthew Appleby, and I'm Hort Week editor, and this is the Hort Week podcast. Make sure you never miss a Hort Week podcast. Subscribe to or follow Hort Week podcasts via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. And once again, thank you to Fiona, and goodbye until next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.